Welcome to Worlds Apart. As Shakespeare contended for centuries ago, war makes for strange bedfellows, a principle that Turkey seems to have taken to heart in the current Ukrainian conflict. On the one hand, President Erdogan calls on NATO to take concrete steps to deter the so-called Russian aggression. On the other hand, Ankara keeps deepening its relationship with Moscow and handsomely benefiting from it. What is Turkey's game? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Yunal Çevikköz, a member of the Turkish parliament and the country's former ambassador to Great Britain and Azerbaijan. It's a great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, I mentioned the war in Ukraine in my introduction, and we are going to mark the 10-month anniversary of it soon. And what's interesting about it is a very peculiar synchronicity, because you and your party issued a statement 2 days before the official launch of that operation, in which you warned about the increased risk of a burning conflict. Did you see that war coming before it began?
Not the war itself, but we actually predicted a kind of a military operation, and we simply thought that it would be dangerous for the whole region. Because since the disintegration of the former Soviet Union, Turkey has developed equitable relations both with Russia and Ukraine, and both countries are our neighbors at the Black Sea, by the seaside, of course. But of course, if those two countries started some kind of a military aggression or a hot conflict, that would, of course, create a serious danger for the whole region. Mm-hmm. That was the reason why we wanted to urge that it wouldn't happen. And we also explained that we do not recognize the developments in the Donetsk and Luhansk area.
Later on, in your speech before the Council of Europe, you called this operation unjustified and unprovoked, and described it not as a war between Russia and Ukraine, but as a war between democracy and authoritarianism. Even if I take this contention without arguing, accepting that Russia is indeed an authoritarian state and Ukraine is a burgeoning democracy, do you think authoritarian states have no security interests worth defending?
No, that is not what I meant, actually. Certainly, every country has its own definition of its own security concerns and threat perceptions. But the issue here is the development of democratic values, which are generally defended by the Western countries, was probably expanding through Ukraine towards the Russian borders. And I think that could be perhaps a concern which the Russian government did not exactly expect to happen.
But Mr. Çevikköz, in addition to the so-called democratic values that you are referring to, there was also a very rapid expansion of military infrastructure, which is not disputed by any of the sides now. It's public record. You know, it could be seen in the American budget, in the public statements of American officials. Don't you think that it was the expansion of military infrastructure that was far more threatening for the Russian government than abstract democratic values that you're referring to?
I do not challenge, of course, the concerns that the Russian side had about its own security concerns. I would probably refer to the history and probably go back to 2007. And in 2007, when President Putin made a very interesting speech at the Munich Security Conference, that was probably not well understood or well taken by the West. And I think it all started then. That is the reason why we have to be careful. And I urge that, of course, that we had to be careful in the development of these, messages coming from the West about a possible membership of Ukraine to NATO,
et cetera. But again, it was not just the messages. I mean, I understand your
That I can't judge, and I cannot confirm that. I mean, of course, there have been several reports about the military infrastructure developing, but I don't think that that would end up with some kind of a war declared by Ukraine towards Russia. It was simply probably a kind of a preparation, which, of course, nobody wanted to happen. But the issue here is what has happened, but we have to return that process, and we have to bring stability to our region. And we have to find a solution to the conflict, because it is not to the benefit of either people. These people are They have been growing together.
Let's talk about how it could be brought back to the negotiating table, because in that seemingly prophetic statement that you made on the eve of the Russian military operation, you called for non-periodic, consistent and peaceful policies to resolve the tensions rather than arbitrating the issues. And I'm particularly interested in this non-periodic. What did you mean by that?
I don't recall what I said and in what context I mentioned. But when I say non-periodic, if I did, then probably it should not be confined in a certain time period. And it should be lasting and it should be continuing. So that is probably the reason why I may have referred to that kind of a word. But the issue here is we have to be careful about not building new dividing walls or dividing lines in Europe. It is in the heart of Europe. And if that continues and if that conflict develops into a more serious hot confrontation, which is actually already the case. I mean, I know that in Russia, officially, it is not accepted as a war, but Turkey has, at the right at the outset, has declared that it is actually a situation of war because we wanted to implement the articles of Montreux Treaty or Montreux Convention based on the concept of war. And the perception from Turkey's point of view was the aggression or the military operation that started by Russia towards Ukraine was the beginning of a war.
Now, I'm sure you've heard the Russians complaining before that the peace process itself has been abused by Ukraine and its Western backers when they signed certain agreements in order to get respite from military fighting rather than with any intention to execute them in good faith. Do you agree with that, having observed that process? And if so, do you think that would influence Russians' readiness for future talks?
It is a fact that the Minsk process has failed. And I can't make any judgment about who has been responsible for the failure of the Minsk process. But if the Minsk process and its subsequent implementation was successful, then we would probably not be in a position like that. But once that the Minsk process has failed and once that it has been perceived as a kind of a threat perception by the Russian side, then probably we should try to find a remedy to revisit and to rehabilitate the Minsk process. The solution should not be a kind of a military solution. We need dialogue and we need continuous attempts for diplomatic solutions to conflicts like
and
that.
And your own country, Turkey, has probably made the most for it because it has actually practically tried to bring the Russians the Ukrainians together for preliminary talks in Istanbul last spring, which seemed to be fairly successful on the surface, but nonetheless failed. What do you think was missing in the Istanbul talks?
I think the trust and confidence between the two countries has disappeared. And although there was a very successful meeting in Istanbul, both delegations were probably very close to an understanding. The delegations who have got together and who met each other were not the final parties who took the decisions. When they went back to their capitals, I think the decision-making process was influenced by other personalities.
You're being extremely diplomatic here, and I see all your previous experience in that one answer, but let me be a little bit more precise with the facts here, because according to President Putin, if we can trust him, after the Istanbul talks, the Ukrainian side submitted in written form its condition for peace, which included the neutral, nuclear-free, non-bloc status for Ukraine, and its refusal from trying to reclaim Crimea by force in exchange for international security guarantees. A few days later, it walked away from that, but do you think it could still form the basis for continuous talks?
I think it was a good beginning, and it was a kind of a proposal which could start the whole negotiations and which could continue for a constructive and positive result. But the fact that it has failed, unfortunately, a couple of days later, brought us to this current situation today. Probably there have been some factors that I cannot judge and I cannot understand who have influenced this process. But as you have mentioned, all those premises which were offered by the Ukrainian side at the outset seemed to be a good beginning.
You, among others, referred to the Russian military operation as an aggression, and at times you called it unprovoked and justified. But Turkey itself has never been shy of extraterritorial operations for the sake of its own security, be it in Syria, in Iraq, or as a member of NATO in Yugoslavia. I wonder if you see any strategic or moral difference between what the Russians are doing in Ukraine and what the Turks were doing or are still doing in Syria or did in Yugoslavia.
I think Yugoslavia is a very separate case because Yugoslavia is a kind of a NATO action, and Turkey has not been participating in the military operations.
But they did provide fighter jets for that bombing.
Yes, but they did not provide fighter troops.
That's a major difference. They didn't provide the humans, but they provided the weapons.
They may have provided the weapons, but they're also providing, for example, the Bayraktar to Ukraine. So it is a kind of a different situation. What I want to make the distinction here is the Yugoslav case is something different because Turkey participated in the Yugoslavia operation in the side of Althea through the European Union and also by NATO operations only for the humanitarian purposes. Whereas the comparison between what has happened in Ukraine and the Turkish armed forces taking certain operations in Syria are entirely incomparable because Turkey was reacting to a kind of a terrorist activity which was actually intruding into the Turkish territory, and Turkey wanted to stop these terrorist activities originating from PKK and also from Syria, from the YPG. Whereas I don't think that there has been any kind of a military or terroristic attack into the Russian territory from Ukraine. So that is the reason why I may have used the unprovoked and unjustified.
Well, there have been some terrorist activities by Ukrainian nationalists on the Russian territory. But apart from that, I'm sure you're aware that the Syrian government strongly objected to any Turkish operation on the Syrian sovereignty. Aren't we getting into the same sort of argument of one man's freedom fighter, another man's terrorist? I mean, if you recognize your country's security concerns as legitimate, why would you deny my country in seeing its security concerns as legitimate, especially given that Russia has taken plenty of measures to negotiate with the West what it deems as threatening?
I think both countries failed to continue with the dialogue. Turkey interrupted the dialogue with Damascus in 2012, and the military operations came only in 2016. But if the dialogue had continued, then there could have been a solution without any kind of a military operation. Probably it is the same because Russia also interrupted the dialogue and ceased to seek for some kind of a diplomatic solution to the conflict or the confrontation that it had with Ukraine. Both countries should have used diplomatic means, dialogue, and should aim also to find a peaceful resolution to the conflicts. I think from this point of view, both countries have committed the same mistake.
Well, Mr. Cevikos, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Yunal Cevikos, a member of the Turkish Parliament and the country's former ambassador to Azerbaijan and Great Britain. Mr. Cevikos, it's clear that you are a very strong advocate of diplomacy, and you should be, but do you believe that there ever comes a point when diplomacy simply exhausts itself, when more forceful measures to defend countries' existential interests are required?
We have a saying, which is a kind of a legacy that we have received from Atatürk. Atatürk, as you know, was, of course, a military commander. And one of the words or the sentences or the mottos that he used was, unless your national interests are vehemently challenged, war is murder. Mm-hmm. That's what he had said. And I think that simply implies that Atatürk also sees war as a very, very last resort.
Now, one thing that I think differentiates any of the Turkish operations in Syria from the Russian operation in Ukraine is the fact that the map, in practical terms, has already changed, regardless whether or not the international community recognizes the accession of four former Eastern Ukrainian regions into Russia or not. You know, that's already the facts on the ground, so to say. What do you think is the best outcome for Ukraine in the current circumstances?
Some people are talking about ceasefire, but ceasefire is not permanent. It is a temporary situation. Ceasefire, perhaps, or farewell to arms for a certain period is necessary, but it has to start with an ultimate aim of establishing peace. Peace is the ultimate key word here. And both sides should sit at the table, not for continuation of peace talks, but reaching to the peace itself. And if they are determined to do that, then ceasefire will not be a very long period. It will probably end up with the peace treaty. But as you have mentioned, there have been so many developments that the Russian parliament, for example, has passed certain resolutions recognizing the annexation of certain areas of eastern Ukraine to Russia. All these have to be seriously negotiated. I don't think that it will change over time, overnight. I don't think that it will happen overnight. It will probably need several years. But in order to achieve that, both countries and both peoples have to reestablish trust and confidence against one another.
Do you think it's just between Ukraine and Russia? I mean, are we calling a spade here? Because I'm sure you know that from the Russian perspective, the Russians see themselves in a war with the West, not with Ukraine, but with the West.
That is the reason why I have referred to the speech of President Putin in 2007 at the Munich Security Conference. Probably President Putin at that time made a very interesting remark about the growing possible danger or the threat perception that he visioned. And he very fairly and very explicitly gave and drew his red lines. It was probably the former Soviet territory that was the red line for President Putin and Russia. That could, of course, been taken seriously by the West, and it could have been a kind of a diplomatic negotiation, and it could probably end up with some kind of a modus vivendi, a kind of an understanding which would never threat Russia, or which would never allow Russia to perceive certain threat perception coming from the West. President Putin, and today actually Minister Lavrov in his speech also mentioned that the West has neglected the threat perception of Russia and expanded towards the Russian territory. When you look at the history, Russia always needs a kind of a Lebensraum or a kind of a buffer zone to guarantee its own security. And probably it would be unacceptable for the Ukrainians because they also say that, of course, they are an independent and a sovereign nation and they have to make their own decisions. But the issue here is, when we prepared the NATO-Russia Founding Act in 1997, we made it very clear that there would be no veto power for Russia for a possible expansion or a possible development of NATO or other countries' choice to become members of NATO. That wouldn't be vetoed by Russia.
But can I, because this is a very interesting argument that is mentioned time and time again by various NATO and American officials. If you give Russia no veto power, doesn't that essentially mean no power at all? And wouldn't that leave Russia with no choice other than doing what it did?
No. It is not what I mean. What I am saying here is there are certain conditions about all the interpretation of this NATO-Russia Founding Act. First, it is true that Russia should not feel that it has a veto power about the decisions of NATO or decisions of third countries to become member of NATO.
Did it ever argue to claim?
No, that is not what I'm saying. What I'm saying here is all those developments should also be taken into consideration whether it is threatening the security of Russia or not. Mm-hmm. And Russia probably has been always thinking that all these developments have been not taken into consideration from the Russian perspective. It has been neglected that it was a kind of a threat perception and a growing threat perception for Russia. If that is neglected and if this is the understanding of Russia, then there's a problem there. And that is simply because of lack of dialogue.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned this word neglect a couple of times, and I wonder if it's the correct one, if it's the accurate one, because there are many political scientists, not only in Russia, but also in the West, who believe that the ultimate goal of the West is to essentially balkanize Russia, to put an end to Russia as a sovereign state. They see it as a threat too, and they would rather have Russia broken into several parts that continue service Western energy needs. But do you think neglect is the right word, or was it deliberate denial of Russia's security considerations?
Some people may think that it was a deliberate denial, but I don't think so, because I have been involved in this process as a drafter of the NATO-Russia Founding Act, and we were very sincere to one another. I mean, together with Ambassador Gebhardt von Moltke, I traveled frequently to Moscow at that time, and we even had meetings with the very distinguished statesman, Mr. Primakov, together with Secretary General Solana. And it was a very open and a very fair and a very candid conversation that we always had. And finally, it came to an understanding that the NATO-Russia Founding Act was the proper vehicle or the instrument which would perhaps give us the opportunity to build a common European security architecture. And there, Russia and NATO were believed to be or perceived about one another as partners. I think neglect is probably the right word from my point of view, but I wouldn't make any comment about other views, because there may be several other people in different countries who may have envisaged other adventurous solutions.
You've just referred to your another experience of yours, professional experience of yours, because in addition to being a parliamentarian and a high-ranking diplomat, you also served at NATO in the early 1990s, at that critical moment when NATO was tasked with redefining or its existential task, finding a new purpose for itself. And it was a time when Russia was truly infatuated with the West. It even fantasized about joining that alliance one day. Do you think, why do you think we are back to this animosity, given that everything seemed to be so rosy after the Cold War?
I think it was very quick. The developments took place very rapidly. You remember in 1989, when the Warsaw Pact disappeared, NATO immediately found that something is changing and bipolarity is probably softening, and probably it's coming to an end. Certainly it came to an end at the end of 1991, when the Soviet Union disintegrated. But the dissolution of Warsaw Pact was a very interesting development. And then NATO reacted to that by establishing the North Atlantic Cooperation Council, by inviting the former Warsaw Pact countries as partners.
As inferior partners. Or junior partners?
Partners, but it was a different body. The body itself was called the North Atlantic Cooperation Council, and it was a kind of a new body which would give a kind of a equal chance to all the partners who were members of the North Atlantic. Yes, but then, of course, NATO always tried to adapt itself to the new conditions. After the disintegration of the former Soviet Union, for example, the post-Soviet geography and all the newly independent states were also invited. to the NACC, to the North Atlantic Cooperation Council. And then in 1994, you would recall that the Partnership for Peace idea was promoted. Russia always thought that Partnership for Peace was a very interesting idea, but it could perhaps create a kind of an unjustified equality to Russia with the other countries. And Russia always saw that it was it had to be treated differently by NATO. That's the reason why we formed the NATO-Russia Council. That's the reason why NATO-Russia Founding Act was signed. So it was a very privileged situation, and it was a very privileged offer to Russia. And it was only for Russia.
Well, all its privileges are on display right now on the Ukrainian battlefield.
I very much regret that it failed. I mean, it hurts, because if you are involved in a process and if you think that you are doing something good for the humanity and for the peace and stability of Europe, and if you see that it is not functioning, it is failing, then it hurts.
You know well that Russia and Turkey have a very complicated history between the two of them, coming from one war to peace to confrontation again to cooperation again. Do you think there's anything that NATO and perhaps the West more generally can learn from the way Moscow and Ankara have been managing their very complicated relationship? It's a kind of relationship that's laden with lots of potential disagreements, and yet it seems to be striving.
This is not the first time that it is happening, because when you look at the history during the Cold War, Turkey has always had very peculiar relations with the Soviet Union as well. Turkey was one of the two countries which was directly having a land border with the Soviet Union. The other one was in the northern flank, Norway. But Turkey, just because of this fact and because of geography and also history, tried to have a kind of peculiar and a very balanced approach towards the Soviet Union. It did not crack NATO, it did not harm NATO's solidarity, but also from Turkey's point of view, it was a very good development. And the Soviet Union has invested into the development of industrial infrastructure of Turkey in 1960s, for example. Nobody challenged that. Now, we are experiencing a kind of a same thing, which is now happening. Although there are sanctions which are implemented by the Western countries, which are mainly by the European Union, and Turkey legitimately says that as we are not a member of the European Union, we do not feel to be obliged to comply with the European Union sanctions. But as far as the United Nations sanctions are concerned, of course, we are abiding by them. But here, I think Turkey is giving some kind of an image to the whole world that it's a very important facilitator. I have mentioned that Turkey has been always equidistant to Ukraine and Russia after the disintegration of the Soviet Union. And that's the reason why Turkey does not want to see an unstable environment, and particularly a war situation, just in the north of its geography. And this is also endangering the whole stability of the Black Sea Basin. So that's the reason why Turkey is probably taking the lead as compared to any other Western country to find some kind of a compromise between the two countries, to negotiate the grain deal, for example. And we will also continue to invest our efforts for the diplomatic solution of the whole confrontation and conflict.
Well, and we here in Moscow definitely wish you success in this very difficult endeavor.
It's not easy. It's not easy, but we will continue to try.
It's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you very much for your candor.
I thank you very much.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.